All right, welcome to this episode and the third season of our show, True Data Ops. I'm your host, Kent Graziano, the Data Warrior. In each episode, we're going to bring you a podcast discussing the world of data ops and the people who are making data ops what it is today. So be sure to look up and subscribe to the dataops.live YouTube channel, because that's where you're going to find all the recordings from our previous seasons. And as we go through this season, all the recordings of the new episodes. So if you missed any of the prior seasons, now's your chance to get started and catch up. Better yet, just go to truedataops.org and you can subscribe so you'll get notifications about the upcoming podcasts. Now, my guest today is a returning guest. He's industry expert, analyst, author, speaker, world traveler, Mr. Mike Ferguson. He's the owner and CEO and head of research for Intelligent Business Strategies. And Mike and I have known each other for quite a while. And again, he's a returning guest. So welcome back to the show, Mike.
Thanks, Kent. Real pleasure to see you again. Haven't seen you since New York earlier in the year.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Data Universe.
There you go.
One of those occasions where we actually were in the same town at the same time at the same show.
Makes a change.
Yeah. All right. For those of you who, folks on our show who don't know much about you, would you give us a little bit of your background in data management? The abbreviated version, because I know it's a long history.
All right. Okay. So over 40 years in the industry, just started out as a regular DBA, but very quickly, I co-founded a company very early in my career with a Turing Award winner, which is Dr. Edgar F. Codd, who of course invented the relational model, which caused the birth of relational databases, the SQL language, et cetera. And another guy at the company, Chris Dade, who wrote lots of books on relational databases. And then
CJ.
I went on to be CJ Dade. There you go. Yeah. Most computer science graduates of a certain age certainly studied that at university. And then I went on to, headhunted and asked to come to the US to become part of a great team, chief architect of a startup called Teradata. Worked there, went there in the late 80s and the early 90s, building massively parallel optimizer for the first massively parallel database aimed at data warehousing industry. And then I came back to Europe. I live in the UK right now, and to set up my boutique industry analyst firm and consulting firm. And I've been in data management and analytics consulting and researching and presenting all over the world ever since. So over 30 years now working for myself. And then more recently, back in 2016, I got together with four great events guys and got involved in an event which we started called Big Data London, which of course runs next week. It's the ninth year now, and it's grown into the largest data and analytics conference in Europe with over 20,000 delegates and over 200 vendors on the exhibition floor and 15 theaters. It's all going to be crazy, over 300 speakers. So next week's going to be huge. Anyway, that's me.
I think you'll be a little tired by the time that's over. That's a huge event.
Yeah. Well, it is. Yeah.
Well, this season on our show, we want to take a step back and think about how the world of true data ops has evolved in the last number of years and what we've learned in the past few years. So, Mike, you were one of the original contributors to the philosophy and the concepts of true data ops and the development of the seven pillars of true data ops. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to kick the season off with you. For listeners, if you've not looked at the seven pillars recently, you can find them at truedataops.org/7-pillars, or just scan the QR code that's showing up on your screen. So after 4 years since we first published the truedataops.org site and the Dummies Guide to Data Ops, how do you feel about the seven pillars? Do they still resonate today with all the changes with AI and everything that's coming in?
Oh, 100% still resonate. I would say more than ever, in my opinion. I mean, I think there's still a lot of people out there who don't know, or let's say, you know, not sure about data ops. And, you know, for that reason, I guess in some cases, data ops practices are adopted, in some cases, maybe partially adopted, or in some cases, not at all. But I think, you know, we've got to do more to educate people about what data ops and the benefits of it for most organizations. But, you know, the way I look upon data ops is it kind of lays the foundation for what I would say is industrializing the development of data analytics. And, you know, before data ops, in a way, before 4 years ago when we defined all of that, it kind of reminds me about, you know, what car manufacturing was before Henry Ford turned up.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I mean, yeah, you can build all your own custom cars, but if you really want to accelerate development, you're going to need a production line. And if you're going to put a production line in place, then you got to get the foundations right, because everyone's got to grasp kind of standardizing development processes in order to be able to really get this thing moving and accelerate the whole, you know, development, to kind of shorten the amount of time and coordinate the amount of, you know, the work, you know, to deliver insights that are going to contribute to outcomes in your business. So in a way, you know, I would say, you know, 4 years on, absolutely, you know, definitely resonates even more so. Perhaps the only thing I would say is that there's a trend that, you know, data ops, rather than being some sort of separate technology all the time necessarily, you know, is starting now to kind of go into bigger platform data fabrics and whatnot as kind of, you know, baked in, if you like, in order to kind of adopt those kind of capabilities within those that kind of tooling, which of course is good, you know, because then, you know, the people using those tools, you know, get to make use of those kind of data ops capabilities and the tooling that they're using.
Yeah, I mean, for decades we've been on this quest for self-service BI, but for data ops we kind of need the same thing, right? We need, it really needs to be more self-service, not just a couple of really good data engineers who know how to use CI/CD tools, for example, right?
100%, 100%, yes. I mean, no question about that. I mean, but we can talk a little bit more about that. I mean, in a second, you know, but certainly, yes. I mean, we kind of got to break them away a little bit, I think, as we go forward into necessarily, let's call it GitHub terminology, when it comes to data ops, you know, because of the direction we're headed.
Right. Yeah. Because previously we would have talked about, you know, doing check in and check out, doing branches and merges, and that's very technical.
Yeah. There's definitely some terminology that if you're not a software developer, you might struggle a bit, you know, grasping, you know, and it's more of a terminology thing, I think, you know, but there's still a little bit of education needed in and around that to get for people to kind of get it, so to speak. But in general, you know, I kind of think we've got to get away a little bit, but we'll talk a little bit of, you know, get away from the kind of techno speak sort of, you know, but still have those data ops practices everywhere.
Right. Yeah. So you've kind of started answering my second question already. You know, now that we've got, you know, this AI and Gen AI are like the rage, do you think that the seven pillars and the data ops approach is more or less important than it was when we started all of this?
Oh, absolutely more important. I mean, I think the reason I'd say that is because Gen AI is just going to cause an explosion of what I would call citizen development, in the sense that, you know, whether that be citizen data modeling or citizen data engineering, or data science, you know, citizen data science feature engineering, or even development of Gen AI apps, et cetera. You know, but basically, we're going to see a lot more stuff because people are going to be using, you know, copilots, natural language prompts in order to build things. And as we democratize, you know, we're going to see a lot more stuff. Now, clearly, whether that's more components and models, more pipelines, more data cleansing jobs, and the last
data products, just the whole idea of producing a data product, right?
100%, 100% data products. But I think the last thing you want is the Wild West in a citizen development environment, and you know, being caused by generative AI based prompt based, you know, development. That'd just be a disaster for most organizations, because I kind of think I'd go as far as to say that without data ops, we could absolutely end up in a Wild West. And we've been there before.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, I was to cast my mind back, you know, kind of 2013 timeframe when we saw the, was that 10 or 11 years ago, when we saw the emergence of self-service data prep. You know, then, you know, we had new startups, you know, the Trifactas, the Paxiles of the world and whatnot, who've both been acquired, you know, now. And then we saw the emergence of self-service data prep getting baked into BI tools and whatnot. But, you know, the attitude then was just like, you know, well, here's the tools, you figure it out. You know, we just kind of pushed the complexity onto the user.
And in many cases, they were business users, right? Not tech.
No, 100%. Business users. And so, you know, it was kind of the last thing you would want, you know, in a self-service environment. I mean, self-service is about taking complexity away, not pushing it on to, you know, people that are lesser skilled, you know, from technical professionals. And so, you know, but those are kind of tools, you know, we just ended up with a mindset of like, well, here you are, everybody, go knock yourself out. And what we got was a Wild West, right? I mean, and we got inconsistency everywhere, and maintenance was a nightmare because nobody knew, you know, who's building what and, you know, with what tools and all of that. But the whole point, I think, of the seven pillars of true data ops is to organize and manage and accelerate collaborative development, not, you know, introduce wild complexity and stall everything. I mean, and so to me, you know, we're trying to shorten time to value when we kind of put that together 4 years ago. And so to me, it's all about building up more, you know, reusable data and analytical products. And that the idea being is that the more that you have available, the less you need to build. And so therefore development gets progressively faster as more and more stuff is ready made. You know, it kind of reminds me, I always use the canteen analogy. You know, if you go for a canteen for lunch and you want to have chicken or something, you don't expect to walk in, somebody hands you a raw chicken and some vegetables and says, here you are, you figure it out. I mean, you want ready made. But what we did 10 years, 11 years ago was exactly that. We just said, here you are, you figure it out, right? There's raw data out there all over the place, you figure it out. And I kind of think that, you know, what we were trying to do with data ops was industrialize the development, speed up our ability to produce data products. And as you incrementally build these, then consumers get progressively faster at using it and delivering value with it, because more and more of what they need is already made. And they don't have to go all the way back to zero and start, you know, developing from scratch again, or potentially even reinventing, you know, if they're not aware of what others have created around the enterprise. So, I mean, you know, the last thing we need right now with Gen AI in the mix is a more rapid way of creating chaos. you know, with prompt-based, you know, generation of code or pipelines or whatever it may be, we just don't want to get the chaos faster. What we need is this thing to be managed. We need it to be organized. And I think, you know, in that sense, you know, data, the seven pillars, is even more needed in a world of Gen AI. But the other thing I would like to say as well is that Gen AI can be used in data ops. I mean, you know, to help automate, you know, certain data ops practices. I mean, for example, if I was thinking about pillar number six, you know, which is really about automated testing and monitoring, you know, then very clearly generative AI could be used there to generate synthetic test data, for example, just as an example, to be used in automating testing or, you know, as part of that pillar. But you could also use it in pillar number five, which is the governance and security and change control. And indeed, you know, I think in several other pillars, you know, that we have in the true data ops definition. So to me, you know, we need data ops in order to manage and, you know, put up an environment that encourages collaborative development and reuse and not chaos in a Gen AI world. And equally, we can also take advantage of Gen AI and data ops itself.
Yeah. I want to do a quick, since we're talking about them, run through what the seven pillars are. So we got ELT, the spirit of ELT, agility, and CI/CD. And what you just mentioned really is component design and maintainability. That's one of our pillars. Environment management. Yeah, there's lots of opportunities to use Gen AI in all of these. The governance and security change control. I mean, in order to avoid the Wild West, the governance and security is actually part of what we really need. Automated testing and monitoring. I think people forget about the monitoring part, which we now tend to call observability, right? Yes. Automated testing, monitoring, because you can use Gen AI and build all this stuff, but if you're not paying attention to what's actually happening after you've built it and deployed it and put it in production, that can be a challenge. And of course, as you've alluded to multiple times, collaboration and self-service. So with that in mind, do you think we need any revisions in this? You know, are some of these needing to be updated now with the advent of Gen AI? Is it still, are those, do they cover it? Does that really still, did we do a good enough job?
I think we did a pretty good job, but I do think there needs to be some revisions. Yes. I mean, not to, you know, kind of replace anything necessarily, but strengthen it more, if you like. I mean, you know, especially now as we really are moving towards, you know, citizen-based data engineering at a pretty rapid rate. I mean, I am more than sure next week at Big Data London, you know, going to be tons of that technology on display as people demonstrate, you know, co-pilots baked into all of their data management tools and whatnot. Just, you know, and it's a good year. In fact, this time last year at Big Data London, we were seeing, you know, the first products emerging. So we're a year into this now. So to me, there's a couple of examples I'd like to give them. If you take pillar number two, which is, you know, what we were talking about, you know, agility and CI/CD, you know, again, I have an issue here because, well, just because I want to see in practice with my clients. I mean, I still think, you know, the people who are, let's say, know this inside and out are the people who came from software development.
Right.
But if I look at even professional data architects and data engineers, you know, we've seen what I would call, I suppose you could describe as a stuttered uptake of CI/CD. I think the reason is simple. I mean, because it came out of software development with kind of GitHub terminology and was very well understood over there, I think data scientists were probably the first, if you like, people working in data and analytics that really grasped that and understood it, because from the get-go they were writing Python or maybe R, but probably Python most of the time.
They're having to version their algorithms.
Yeah, they were having to version everything and check stuff in and version control it all. And pretty early on, most data science tools were already plugged in into GitHub or Bitbucket or whatever version control system you're using. And I think in that sense, but you know, data engineers didn't necessarily come out of a software development background. They may have come out of a drag and drop ETL or ELT background, where they're not really writing a lot of code, and they're not overly familiar with that kind of terminology and so I don't think they understood it as well as they should.
Oh, and they definitely weren't doing it at the database level.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
If we're lucky, they might have been versioning their DDL scripts, but they weren't.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
But they weren't versioning them. They weren't versioning the schemas or the databases themselves or the data in the database.
Yeah, but I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, without a doubt, CI/CD has been incredibly successful and very beneficial in helping shortening development times. It's made maintenance way, way, way easier. But the problem for me is we're now heading into this world of citizen data engineering using generative AI prompt-based user interfaces. And the idea that they fully understand GitHub terminology is just, sorry, but no. I mean, I just don't think that's going to be the case. And I think because we are quite actively out there encouraging democratization, for me, we have to present the idea of CI/CD in a much more business user friendly way, better terminology, or to make it easier for them to grasp it in a more layman's terminology.
That makes sense.
Or I even think just automate it or hide it or have it baked into the tooling where it just kind of takes place, but it's kind of not described as, we'll issue a pull request. I mean, talk to a business user in marketing or finance, a pull request, they're looking at you like you've got three heads or something. I mean, it's just not, particularly friendly. And if we are deliberately moving to the world of data producers, pushing them out into the business to get them to develop pipelines using prompt-based data engineering, we've got to find a better way to describe this and get them into the habit of using these practices, or even have guardrails where they have to use those practices. But we should certainly not be talking about it using GitHub terminology. I mean, and I think, so that's one example of where I think we need some kind of revision. I think another division would be pillar number three, which is component-based design and maintainability. Now, I mean, that needs improved in my opinion, just to create more clarity. Let me explain what I mean by it. Because I think when I first contributed to this 4 years ago, along with you and several others, I was originally thinking about data components, data products, was front of mind, and I think that can be brought together, multiple data products to serve different analytical workloads. That was forefront. So I was kind of thinking of, rather than having monolithic data stores, we create these component based.
Right.
Building blocks, data building blocks, as data products. But at the same time, component design goes way deeper than that. I mean, it's not just about code. We can have, data concepts in a business glossary. You can have, so therefore you could actually have component-based data modeling, data model components. We can have component-based data engineering, which has been around a long time. Long before data apps came about, component-based ETL development's been talked about for decades. It's just that perhaps, we haven't practiced it as well. But the whole idea about thinking about that, or component-based services like cognitive services, I don't know, voice to text or sentiment analysis. You got some content like voice and you need to convert it to text. There's a service for that. There's a component for that. Or if I need sentiment analysis done, there's a component for that. Or if I need to translate one from one language of the world to another language of the world with regards to textual data, then there's a component for that, and so I think the whole idea, or the secret, if you like, of success with pillar number three is organization of the components to make them findable and make them reusable. And so to me, there needs to be kind of clear lines of the different types of components. We have a pillar there that says component design and maintainability. But you want to kind of turn the lens on that and a little
we
bit
need
more
to drill
focus.
In on it a bit more,
drill on it a bit more detail, if you like. Yeah, exactly right. And to kind of create things like shareable libraries and templates and stuff like that to kind of have these components. What we don't want is 20 different components that do the same thing. And then people getting confused over this, and then we end up with I kind of think we need to associate these components, if you like, with maybe stages of data engineering, like, ingestion components or data cleansing components, data cleansing components or transformation.
We need a taxonomy for the components.
We need exactly.
We need taxonomy for the components. The data mesh theories all talked about, even on the data product side, they had to be discoverable and understandable.
Right.
And we're
right.
Really,
much like
kind of coming together.
Yeah, much like you've got a data marketplace, telling people what's ready made from a data product perspective, you kind of need the same idea from a component perspective. If we're going to get into, if you were going to make pillar seven really work, which is collaborative and self-service, development, collaboration. So if you really want that collaborative development to work, we do need a taxonomy so people aren't reinventing stuff when it's already available and we can share it. And, so I kind of think we need to organize that far better. And we need, we need an inventory of what all these components are. We need a taxonomy. We might even have critical code elements, and even what I would see going on in data now, we might need for components. Like, I'm beginning to see data intelligence in catalogs, which know about where all the sensitive data is and all, but I kind of wonder, do you even need component intelligence? But by that I mean things like frequency of use and components never used, and as you say,
that's
different
part of observability. That's part of the
monitoring.
Well,
yes,
really.
In a way it is. You're quite right. I mean, the last thing you kind of want, especially in a world of citizen data engineering using generative AI, the last thing you want is a component graveyard that's kind of littered with, stuff.
We used to talk about that in the data warehousing world of like, well, do we know that the tables we built are being used, right? And trying to put that kind of monitoring is like, when was the last time that data was even queried? It was a big business priority back, 2 years ago. And then you're loading it, refreshing it every night, but is anybody actually using it? But it's the same thing if we're going to build component-based data products and environments like that. Yeah, you don't want duplicates. You don't want, three products that are producing customer data, and you don't know which one to use. And you don't also want a product out there that's just flat not being used. It's taking up resources. We've productionalized it. So you've got your assembly line going along, chugging along every minute of the day, building, rebuilding, refreshing data, and that costs. And if there's any of that that's not actually being used and isn't of value to the business, well, you want to turn that part of the production line off, right?
100%. I mean, in a way, I think data ops, the whole idea behind data ops, or a major purpose of it at least, was to stop sprawl, like that.
Yeah.
And to accelerate managed development and encourage collaborative development and reuse and sharing. And I think we probably need to drill deeper on on that area in order to, if you like, promote absolute clarity and get maximum reuse out of all of that stuff, you know, in order, and whilst of course having, you know, full traceability and whatnot. So yeah, to me, yeah, maybe the idea of a marketplace and a taxonomy or something like that, you know, it really matters.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, Mike, as usual with you and I, we just blew right through that 30 minutes in no time. And we could go on for probably a couple of hours on this diving into it. So we're definitely going to have to get together after Big Data London and all your other travels and get with Justin and Guy and talk through some of this. Guy, you've got some really good points there. And I think it is time that we, you know, maybe go back and we put a little more detail and maybe revise some of the detail under those seven pillars, and it's time for that. Yeah.
But I think as you said, sorry, you know, data observability, you know, wasn't really out there when
wasn't a word.
Yeah, it wasn't when we defined it, where it is now, and absolutely, you know, if there was anything missing, if you like, or needed to be added and strengthened, I would definitely have that very much as part of data ops today, you know, that.
Right. Got to at least have a reference to it in there somewhere, and it might be under monitoring.
Yep.
And maybe we change it to observability and monitoring or something like that. But I think we do need to dive into that. So, okay, I know next week, Big Data London, you've given a good pitch for it already. Do you have anything else you want to say about Big Data London next week, other than how much fun it's going to be?
Well, no, it's going to be great fun. But I mean, you know, if any of you watching this are going to get there, it'd be great to see you. You know, make sure you come along and say hi. I'll be hosting the Great Data Debate with executives from, you know, Calibra and SAP and IBM and AWS, you know, so it should be on Snowflake. So it should be a really great time. But also, if anyone wants to follow up with me anyway, you can look at my website. I think there's a QR code for that.
Yeah,
or, you know, I go into all of this stuff that we've talked about in all kinds of detail in my educational classes. And so if you're interested in that, there's a QR code there as well
and of course you're out on LinkedIn. People can find you there.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And if you're tuning into this, you probably saw the event scheduled on LinkedIn. you can find Mike that way as well. Then you don't have to go searching around LinkedIn for him. You can just go there. Well, thanks again, Mike, for coming here
and
for your insights. It's great as always to catch up with you and talk about these things. You know, thanks to everybody out there listening and for joining us online, and those of you who are going to watch the replay on this. Thanks for joining in, and hope it was educational for you. Be sure to join us again in 2 weeks. My guest is going to be David Garrison, who's a principal data architect and data ops expert from National Grid. He's also a Snowflake data superhero. So he's a practitioner in the field. So we're going to have a great time talking him of what it's like on the ground these days with data ops and true data ops. So as always, be sure to like the replays from today's show. Tell your friends about the True Data Ops podcast. And don't forget to go to truedataops.org and subscribe so that you don't miss any of our future episodes. Until next time, this is Kent Graziano, the Data Warrior, signing off for now.